at all? Or? I think it'd be great. It is the Believer's College in the land. It's an awesome work. A lot of great things are happening through it, and I think David might share a little of that. David has been he's on our Jews for Jesus board, was in the Canadian board, now on the European board. He has an incredible testimony. That's when Lord radically got a hold of him, I think in the 70s, early 70s. And he has been an associate dean at the Pentecostal Assemblies of Canada Seminary. But anyway, he's a great Bible teacher, and I've been blessed. He's been staying in our house, and I've learned an incredible amount by just my conversations with him, and God's used him. And so I'm so blessed to have him be able to share with us tonight. David.
Shabbat shalom. It did feel a little bit different today, not running down to the shuk to do the last minute groceries before Shabbat coming, and then rushing home. I tend to do the grocery shopping and the cooking on Erev Shabbat in our house, and so my wife gets a little bit of break. But today was a little bit different. So being with you, it's nice that we have this time together this evening. Just a little bit about the college. I don't want to talk too long about that, but God has given us the privilege of working in the land and doing ministry there. The Israel College of the Bible has just completed its 14th year in its existence. We had about 110 students this last year, 65 Israelis, 45 international students. We teach our courses in four different languages: Hebrew, English, Russian, and Amharic, which is the language of the Ethiopian Jews. We are adding Spanish to our list this fall coming, and I have requests to add French to that as well. And so it's amazing when you are at the center of the world, all that happens in Jerusalem. But we have courses that are given all around Israel, not just in Jerusalem. We do the four languages in Jerusalem, but we also teach in Beersheba, Arad, Tel Aviv, Haifa in the north, and from time to time Netanya. And so we get around the country with opportunities to do training where people are living and working. Our Israeli students are mostly part-timers. Our foreign students are mostly full-time. And it's just the way things work, with Israelis having to work one or two jobs just to try and survive. So the average Israeli salary is somewhere about $1,500 US a month. And that's the average. So you can imagine what a young Messianic believer makes. They make between $800 to $1,000 a month, and yet their housing rent's going to cost them $500 or $600. And so one job is not enough. Both spouses work, and on it goes. It is not an easy situation. But somehow we find money for cell phones. And so we have one of the highest per capita cell phone usage anywhere in the world. And our family, people say, do you have a cell phone? What is a cell phone? I don't know what that is. We have one for every member of our family. But when a bomb goes off, you're glad to have them. And everybody calls in. We have a rule that whenever we're aware of a bombing of any type or an attack, everyone calls home or calls dad's cell phone, and we make sure everyone is fine. My son called, if you remember, when Colin Powell was in Israel about a year ago, and was taking off from the Knesset area to go to Ramallah to see Arafat, when a bomb exploded not far from where his helicopter was, and he landed and came and inspected and decided he wasn't going to continue on to meet with Arafat at that time. I had just got back. It was a Friday. I had just got back from the shuk and was putting the groceries away, and I got a call from my eldest son, and I said, hello, and he said, Dad, I'm okay. So you only begin a conversation that way if there's a possibility that you might not be okay. Okay, where are you? Well, I'm in the shuk, and I'm in such and such a shop. He says, a bomb has just gone off. I'm okay. Then the phone goes dead. You know? I had just come back from there myself, and I know that the Israelis, what happens quite often is we will clear all the phone lines, so that the cell phones can be used by the emergency services and ambulances and all the rest of that. So they just kind of wipe the slate clean. It's like doing a reset on your computer, and everyone who's talking, their calls gets cut off. You hope it's not due to another explosion or something like that. But we are in the center of all of this in Jerusalem, We live in Jerusalem in the southern area of the city. From my office, if you go about a third of a mile in all directions from my office, there have been 17 bombs in the last 3.5 years that have exploded, three of them within 100 yards of my office. And I have seen the results of bombing only too closely, and I'm thankful to God that we have been spared, in some cases very closely so. But we are called to Israel at this time in our lives to do something very special in our college. Ministry is meant to be able to help Israelis. It may sound like a kind of a blasé thing, you know, Bible colleges and education and all the rest of this. But in Israel, 80% of the congregational leaders have less than one semester Bible training of any description. And 10% have up to 1 year, and only 10% have a complete program. And so when you think about it, although there's fantastic growth, when the State of Israel became a nation in 1948, there were only two Messianic congregations. Now there are over 100. And most of that growth has taken place in the last 14 years, since 1990. And so in 1990 to present, we've probably added somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 to 75 congregations in that 14-year period of time. God is doing something amazing. But if we're going to keep the harvest, then we have to have the necessary depth to be able to do the teaching and leading that are necessary. This might also seem strange to you, there, Jerusalem being the city that it is, there are all kinds of seminaries and theological schools, and you kind of say, well, you know, what makes you different? And one of the things that makes us different is that some of these schools have literally signed an agreement with the Israeli government not to register Jewish students. Israeli Jewish students, foreign Jewish students of any description. And the government treats these schools wonderfully. You want visas for your teachers, you want visas for your students, you want deals, we'll give you deals. Just sign on the dotted line. Now, we have refused to do that, and we've had some very interesting moments because the government knows that we are training Messianic students. And so the head of the Religious Affairs Office, it used to be a ministry, now it's only an office, is well aware. In fact, he's used the word heretics in describing us in the past, but he likes us, of all things. And so our students who are from abroad get their visas, and he did offer me an amazing opportunity. I come from a Pentecostal background. He offered me the opportunity to become a Pentecostal pope in Israel, and I told him, it don't work that way. And God has given us extreme favor with these offices, and we have not hidden anything. We've applied, we've got accreditation internationally from the Asia Theological Association and the European Evangelical Accrediting Association, so our credits are good here in America or anywhere in the world, except for Israel. Okay? So we're living and working in Israel, but we're not recognized there. We're in the process of getting that recognition. So we filed our initial request with the Israeli government. Our lawyer suggested that we tell the government that this is a school for Messianic believers and that people must be members of a Messianic congregation so that the government will not think that the school is a missions organization out to convert Jews. The school is an educational institution. So we followed the lawyer's advice, and we put that in our application, and we got a letter back from the Ministry of Education saying they were processing it, and they had a few comments, and one of them was that they were concerned that we might be breaking the law. Which law is it? And that is the non-discrimination clauses in the education laws that say that we should, if we're going to have recognition, need to offer our education to anyone who qualifies and who is interested in studying. So if a Jew wants to find out about Jesus and study in our Bible college, we should let them do that. And so this is the opposite to sign on the dotted line and not let any Jews study. So we've got one department that calls us heretics, and the other one wants us to open our doors to everyone. Our school has had some interesting comments through the years. One of my neighbors is the sister of a former cabinet minister in the Barak government, and so from a well-known politically placed family in Israel. And this woman, who has a master's degree in theology from Hebrew University and Bible, said, can I teach at your school? Very interesting. She knows we're Messianic, knows exactly what that means, and she's not but she wants to, she likes what we're doing. Can I teach at your school? And so I didn't say no. I said, give me your resume, you know, we'll see. And but who knows, God is giving us interesting favor among the Israeli population, and we are hiding nothing about what we're doing. And so pray for us as we go through this process, because we have to open all the files and all the documents and everything. And so we can't play the double game with the government. They have to be able to see all that we're doing. And we are excited about what the Lord is doing in and through our school, as we are the only college offering a full program of studies for Israelis. And that is an exciting place to be. This fall, we're starting two new programs for current leaders. You can't tell someone who's leading a congregation, go back to Bible school and take Bible 101. You know, they're just not going to do it. It's too offensive to say that to them. So we have designed two new graduate level programs, because most congregational leaders have at least a bachelor's degree, although not in Bible or theology or ministry. And we're offering a program in counseling and another program in leadership. And in that, we're putting Bible courses and other ministry and ethics and whatnot in that, and offering these advanced level programs by invitation only. And so we are getting a very warm response. So pray that the Lord will help us with these new programs. And we are planning a kickoff retreat in the fall with someone you might know, Gary Collins, who's well known in the U.S. for counseling. He's a new leadership guru kind of guy, written over 70 books, has volunteered to come to Israel and do our kickoff weekend in these programs. And we're going to be inviting not only the students of our programs, but also pastors, leaders of Messianic and of Arab congregations to join together for this training weekend. So God is doing some wonderful things. I'm having fun. I'm a Canadian of Gentile descent. I have more Mi'kmaq Indian blood than I've got Jewish blood in me. And God has a sense of humor and has taken us over to Israel. And last year I taught a course, Biblical Hebrew, teaching it in modern Hebrew to Israelis. And so you want an interesting challenge, try that one for a moment. So we're having a lot of fun there, and I work with a really great team, and God has blessed us that way. So if you think about us, remember us in prayer. If you want to take a year off and come, or a summer school course in the future, you can find us on the web at simply www.israelcollege.com. All right, well, enough for the paid announcement there about, or the unpaid announcement there. I want to share with you this evening a text, and it fits right in with the worship that we had this evening, the songs that Michael picked for us to sing in our worship to God, reading from Psalm 24. So if you want to read in your Bibles, I'm going to read it in Hebrew, and I'm not going to preach to you in Hebrew, but I'll read it in Hebrew, and then I will work through it. Psalm 24. Le David Mizmor. La Adonai Haaretz Umilua Tevel Veyoshveva. Ki hu al yamim yesada. Ve'al neharot yechonena. Mi yale bahar Adonai umi yakum b'makom kodsho. Nuki kapaim uvar levav, asher lo nasa leshave nafsho, velo nishpa lemirma. And my screen is small, so it takes a moment as I jump. Yisav racha me'et Adonai, utztaka Elohe yisho. Ze dor dorshav, dorshav mevakshe panecha, Elohe Yaakov Selah. The psalm starts off with Le David Mizmor, a psalm of David. This introduction, very, very short in Hebrew, sometimes in the English Bible, gets put in fine print somewhere above the text. And that's why the numbering of the psalms in Hebrew and English is sometimes off by one number or one verse. And it simply means a psalm for David. Now, we don't know if it means it's David's because he wrote it, It's David's because someone wrote it for him and gave it to him. It's David's because someone dedicated it to him or wrote it in his honor and his memory. And as we go through the text this evening, that particular question will come back to us, and you'll have a chance to see why I'm even raising it. Because we have sometimes assumed that because it says a Psalm of David, that David wrote all these Psalms. Now, David was an amazing songwriter, and he wrote dozens and hundreds of poems and songs to God. But that doesn't mean that they're all included in the Bible, or all that we have with this particular heading on it are ones that he wrote. But this one is certainly got his name in dedication to it. It begins by saying that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness, or her fullness, the world and her inhabitants, the her being the world and the earth. It's interesting that in Hebrew it starts off by simply saying, La Adonai. There is no verb to have in Hebrew. Now, if you've studied Spanish, okay, so I wouldn't ask you about French. I come from Canada, and so we always learn French as a second language. You tend to learn Spanish as a second language here in the U.S. But if you studied Spanish, you know that there are auxiliary verbs. There's two most important verbs in Spanish. One is to have, the other one is to be. Same thing in French, in most of the Romance languages. In fact, most languages of the Western world. But in Hebrew, there is no verb to have. There is a verb to own, but there is not a verb simply to have. So we use the preposition to or for, and then it gives the idea. And so the world and her fullness, the earth in her fullness and the world and her inhabitants are for the Lord. They belong to the Lord. And it's a very simple statement, but it gives us a number of things. And before we get into the actual content, I want to talk to you a little bit about Hebrew poetry. So that if you forget everything I've said this evening, and I hope you don't, but if you do forget everything I say this evening, remember how to read poetry. See, Hebrew poetry is a little bit different than English poetry. You know, we don't do the roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, and so are you, and all the bad poetry we used to make up as kids or even as adults. And stuff that you can say to your beloved girlfriend and whatnot that she'll swoon over, everyone else is gone, you know, give me a break. But we have our way of doing poetry, and we like to have rhythm and rhyme. Now, in Hebrew poetry, there may be rhythm. Rhythm very differently than what we would do, but there is rarely rhyme. Most poets are not interested in rhyme at all. But in Hebrew poetry, what we are interested is using, of course, high-level language, beautiful imagery, but also something called parallelism. Now, unfortunately, this is the aspect of Hebrew poetry that American Christians and most Western Christians just don't get. And because of that, we come up with all kinds of really weird stuff. And so I've been in places and listened to sermons about praise and highest praise. And they are defining these two things, because in one of the verses in the Psalms, it talks about praise and highest praise, and so they all of a sudden, like, these are two different things. And as you read the Psalms, or even the prophets, because most of our English Bibles do us a disservice. If you have a Bible that's written with two columns, sometimes it's very hard to tell how the text is written in Hebrew. And so every verse is kind of highlighted, and the text starts again in every verse. If you have a one-column Bible, which is a little bit rare, you'll have paragraphs, and then when you get into poetry, it's written, it looks like poetry. Did you know that most of the prophets wrote in poetry? Think about it. Remember when King Saul was, the Spirit came on King Saul at one point, and someone heard him singing with the prophets. And he said, Saul is among the prophets, because he was singing prophetic message. And so poetry and prophecy actually go together in experience. And so when you're reading Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea and all the prophets, a lot of that text is pure, pure poetry. Wonderful stuff. But if you don't get this idea of parallelism, you're going to come up with weird doctrines. Why? because the authors repeat the same idea twice with different words to give you the full picture. It's kind of like a verbal 3D or a verbal hologram, if you will, okay? And so instead of projecting this hologram picture that you can look at it from all these different angles, the authors use parallel statements so that they can give you the picture. So we take a look at this first verse as an example, and it says, "To the Lord is the earth and her fullness, the world and her inhabitants." Now, it's very easy if we stop at the first part of this and says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof," in the wonderful terms of King James. Wow, you think about it, okay? And so Jonathan was showing me the beautiful lake just down the road from his house, and we're driving along here and we see all the trees and the flowers, and people ask me, "What do you miss in Israel?" Green. We miss green. We miss water. We miss a number of things. We miss the seasons. But, you know, all this beauty of the world, and people can talk about the mountains and the glorious sunrises and sunsets and all that. That's all wonderful. But is that what this text is talking about? Is the fullness of the earth simply nature? Well, you get the next line and it explains it for you. The world and her inhabitants. The other stuff is beautiful. The other stuff is wonderful. Creation is glorious. But people are better. Ever heard the joke, the pastor that says, "I love the church, it's just the people I can't stand"? You know, get another job, okay? You need to be doing some other kind of line of work or something. But the reality is that God makes this wonderful universe and this glorious world in which we live, and He's working towards something, and finally He creates man and woman, and He says, "That's it. That's really cool." This text is telling us that we, His creation, we, the fullness of the world, we that give the world its actual meaning, belong to the Lord. Now that's something we don't like to hear in our society today, because we are a very individualistic people. I am my own person. And we have, in the Western world, defined freedom differently than our forefathers have. We have defined freedom in such a way that it is simply anarchy. Everyone doing what's right in their own eyes, that's freedom. Friends, that is not freedom. That's a recipe for disaster. You can be free, but you set limits on your freedom. Freedom doesn't mean that I can steal my neighbor's car, that I can beat up his kids. I am not free to do whatever I want. There are limits to my freedom, as well there should be. How do we decide these things? Well, I am the Lord's. I'm not my own man. He made me. He had a purpose when He made humanity. He had a purpose when He allowed me to be born into this world. And the question we need to ask ourselves, are we fulfilling His purpose for our lives? And if we're not, we're missing the mark. Friends, I don't need to give you the 613 mitzvot to see if I can find one of those 613 that you're not keeping. The reality is, if all we have to do is stop for a moment and saying, am I with my life fulfilling all that God wants me to be? And if the answer is no, I don't need to go down that list to find where I'm a sinner, because I'm already missing the mark. We are the Lord's. We belong to Him. He's the one who has all the rights to make whatever rules of the game that He wants. Well, if we need an explanation, it says we belong to the Lord, but why do we belong to the Lord? Because He founded the earth on the seas. And this dry land on the rivers. Think about this as imagery for a moment, if you will. Again, we have parallelism. And in fact, in Hebrew, it's beautiful here. If we see that in the first verse, it started with La Adonai, for the Lord, and then we have parallel statements. We have earth, world, fullness, her inhabitants. The next one we have Kihu, because he, what? This applies to both statements. On waters, streams, founded, and established. All parallel words. This is synonymous parallelism, giving us this wonderful picture. And if we think about the picture for a moment, it's like there's the water, and God, what is he doing? Think of Genesis chapter 1. The first day, God separates the light from the darkness. The second day, he separates the sky from the sea. And the third day, he separates the water from the dry land. Now, we're not going to get into the day thing. We can do that another time if you invite me back. But in this text, when you think of the third day of creation, it's like the waters open up. And as they open up, the land begins to rise, as if it's floating on the seas. Now, we know it's not quite floating on the seas. It is floating. It's floating on a molten core of the inner core of the world. But it's that picture. And the psalmist is aware of that picture, and he's using it and saying, since the Lord was able to do all of that, he is the creator. We belong to him. Why? Because he made us. He made it all. He made the world in all her fullness, and all her inhabitants. We come from him. Now let me say this. You may not think that you, as an individual, came from him. Maybe your background has a few skeletons in the closet. I can tell you that in my own personal life, when I became a teenager, became aware of a few of the facts of life, and started to do the math, as they say, I was the firstborn in my family, and the math didn't quite make it. You know, someone asked, the little child asked Grammy, how long does it take a baby to make a baby? And Grammy says, the wise old grandmother says, dearie, the first one can come at any time. All the others take 9 months. So I could do the math, and I could say, my start in this world was not all that illustrious. And that caused a lot of torment for me for some time. If my parents had been good people, I would never have been born. So why am I here? Then I was reading in Ephesians, and it says that he blessed me with all spiritual blessings from before the foundation of the world. God knew my parents were going to make a bad decision at one moment in time, and that I would come into this world, and God chose, before he created Adam and Eve, to have a blessing for me in this world, no matter how I got here. And sometimes when we wonder about our value as people, we judge ourselves by the wrong measuring stick. God is the author of life, and he has given it to us. We are his. He loves us and he blesses us, but he is the one who sets the agenda. Now the text goes on, and it's coming to the crux of what I want to share with you. I live in Jerusalem, obviously, from what I said earlier, so that's nothing new to you, but it's interesting. You know, Jerusalem, the holiest city for two of the world's religions, and the third holiest city for Islam, although we're not exactly sure why. Okay? It's not mentioned in the Quran. How does it become the third holy city? There's politics involved in everything, but let's say it is, okay? So this is the city, the holiest city on the face of the earth. You can go to, if I asked you what the biggest synagogue is in Jerusalem, you would say, what would you say? Oh, come on, come on, take a risk, take a risk. What's that? The Great Synagogue? Good guess. As far as buildings are concerned, the answer would be yes. But the largest synagogue is actually the Western Wall and the open plaza there, because you can get a whole lot more people praying there than you can in the Great Synagogue. But whether you want it to be the Western Wall or the Great Synagogue, the effect is the same. I generally go to the Great Synagogue on Erev Yom Kippur, Yom Kippurim. I walk there. Only one year I went to a Sephardic synagogue instead. I've met Bibi Netanyahu a couple times, shaking his hand. I'm sure he remembers me. And, you know, but when I went into the synagogue, Yom Kippurim, nobody asked me if I was a Jew. They just wanted to know one thing. Did I cover my head as I went into the sanctuary? Of course I did. I've got my own talit, I've got a kippah, I forgot my kippah and kippah clip, and this one kept falling off, and I didn't want to embarrass myself by it happening during the sermon. But, you know, into the Great Synagogue, I wear my kippah, and away I go. And I've taken my sons with me, and we've gone in to pray with our Jewish friends. All I had to do was make sure my head was covered and dress appropriately, and I was in. Now, I've been up on the Temple Mount. Most Jews haven't had that opportunity to do so. One, the rabbis have warned them against going onto the Temple Mount because you might accidentally step on the place where the Holy of Holies was. Okay? And that could be a curse for you or desecration of it. On and on goes in the rabbis' minds. So there's big signs saying, if you're a Jew, don't go up here. Then, of course, the Muslims are really happy that the rabbis did that because they don't want you up there anyways. And so, but as a Gentile, I've gone up there on a number of occasions in better days and have gone into which one of the two mosques is the holier of the mosques, the Golden Dome or the Al-Aqsa. It's the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is the ugly one, which is actually the more holy one for Muslims. And so I've gone in there, and they haven't asked me, are you a Muslim? If you're going to come in here, you got to say you're a Muslim. They've only wanted to see one thing. Did I take my shoes off at the door? Did I leave my shoes outside and come in socking feet? And then if I walk a little bit down the road and I go to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and if I want to go into that place, they're not going to ask me if I'm a Christian. They just want to make sure I take my hat off. So, hats on, hats off, shoes off. Don't get it mixed up. It could be embarrassing, okay? But the fact of the matter is, they are sticklers. And so if women walk into a place and they don't have long enough sleeves, or the skirts are not long enough, or guys are wearing the wrong kind, if they're wearing muscle shirts or no hat, whatever, someone is going to tell you that you are dressed wrong and inappropriate for the place. Now, the text we have in front of us asks an interesting question. Who may go up into the mountain of the Lord? And who can stand in the place of his holiness? Guy who's wearing the kippah or the guy who's not wearing the kippah? The guy who's wearing the shoes or the guy who's not wearing the shoes? What's the answer? The reality is the answer is none of the above. We're not talking about simply a place. Because when you think about this, this is where it raises the question about who wrote it. You see, if David wrote this, we have a slight problem. Because it's obviously talking about the temple on the mount in Jerusalem. Okay? Going up to the mountain of the Lord. That can only be one of two places. It's either Moriah, where the temple was, or Sinai. So the only two places that are called the mountain of the Lord. One of those two. And then when it says the place of his holiness, then it is the dwelling place of the holiness of God. Likely it's the Temple Mount on Moriah in the city of Jerusalem. Well, if that's the case, we have a slight problem because David wanted to build the temple, but God wouldn't let him because he was a man of war and there was blood on his hands. So David only buys the land and he gives it to his son with a pile of money, and Solomon later builds the temple and they celebrate the dedication after David is dead. So David is not writing a psalm about going into the temple, into the place of God's presence. Because all they had at that time was the tabernacle that was moving around, which wasn't necessarily on any mountain whatsoever. So this is likely written by someone after David's time, but who and when, we don't know from that. But it asks the question. And the question, the mountain of the Lord and the place of the Lord's holiness, is the same place. It's not two places. It's not like who can go there and there, but who can go into this one place? And the answer is a surprising one for us, and one that I think is key in the whole understanding of biblical holiness. In one verse, you get it all. And we're going to get to it in a moment. We, as believers, set too many human criteria with which to keep people out of religious places that don't fit the picture. And so I've been in a Christian church when a young man, punker, walks into the congregation with a baseball cap on his head and walks in and sits down in the middle, and the ushers are having hearts attack in the back. You know, they get the little phone. You know, you want to give somebody power, give them a little phone that has a phone up on the platform to ring the pastor during the service. Now they got power, and they're dialing the pastor on the platform, and he picks up the phone. They say, "Pastor, you see that guy with the hat who just came in? What do we do?" Pastor said, "Leave him alone. Leave him alone." At the end of the service, the pastor goes down, talks to the young man, introduces himself, and the young man says, "I wanted to see what kind of church this was." And then he takes off his hat and apologizes. "I had to know what was important to you. It was a test. Is my hat the thing? Or me?" And so often we get it backwards. We get it all wrong. We put the emphasis on things that don't matter and miss the things that do. And what matters here, we have in our text a simple statement that is in our text, and it is verse 4. Who can go up into the mountain of the Lord? He who has clean hands, a pure heart, who doesn't lift up his soul to idols or to that which is false, and who does not swear wrongly or falsely. There are four things. Now, when you look at these four things, you can say to yourself, man, you know, like these aren't four of the Ten Commandments. These aren't four of the 613 mitzvot. What's the author trying to do? Come up with a new list? Do we add these four to the 613? Or maybe there's one that's kind of similar. So do we say, 615, 616? What do we do with this? Do we replace that list with this? What is this all about? Remember, this is poetry. And we have parallelism at work. And we have four things being listed and four things that are being picked specifically for a reason. And I want you to picture this. If I had a blackboard, this is the teacher in me. I want to write something on a blackboard here for you. But you'll get this. If you look at the list of four things, the first two are written positively. He who has pure hands, clean heart. And then the next two are written negatively, who does not lift up his soul to idols, and who does not swear falsely. So two of the statements are written positively, and two of the statements are written negatively. That's the first picture. Keep that in your mind. We have positive and we have negative. Now I want you to look at each of the two things. The two positives. One is what? Clean hands, pure heart. One is outside, physical. One is inside, internal. And then if we look at the negative things, one is who doesn't lift up his soul to the worship of idols or that which is false, which is internal, and who does not swear falsely, who's speaking of what you do with your tongue, which is external. Now, when you think about this for a moment and begin to get a picture, now we have four things, and you make a table with four quadrants on it. Two are positive, two are negative, two are internal, two are external. And if we look at our society today and where people are when they talk about holiness, think about it. Now, those of you who come from a Gentile Christian background, when you hear the word holiness, you're going to have a certain perspective of it. And those who come from a Jewish background are going to have another perspective about it. But guess what? They both come down to this. Quite often, it's what you weren't allowed to do. Okay? So, you can't do this on Shabbat. You can't do this on Yom Kippurim. You don't wear these kind of clothes. You don't eat this kind of food. You don't. Okay, so there's the Jewish don'ts. And then we have, on the Christian side, if you come from an evangelical background, you don't drink alcohol, and you don't smoke cigarettes, and you don't take drugs, and you don't go to the movie theater, and you don't dance, and you don't. And we have a long list of don'ts. And so holiness was defined by what you don't do. Good people don't. That's all wrong. That's only part of the truth. There's a lot of people who don't, but they never get around to doing anything. And their lives are miserable, failures, unhappy, but they don't do all these bad things. And they feel good about being righteous, but they sure don't enjoy life at all. And then in our society, we've got this reaction, because that's the old-fashioned way. And so who wants to be part of an Orthodox family when you can't do all of these things? So let's go join the Reform family. Let's join the Reform synagogue. You want to be an evangelical, let's go join the Episcopals or the Methodists or some other group that's going to let us do all of those things, and away we go. And then we say to people, listen, don't judge me by what you see on the outside. It's my heart that counts. Okay? Let's take a big example. You're Jimmy Swaggart and you fall into sin and you say, I know I did wrong things, but my heart is okay. I've got a good heart. Do we believe that kind of stuff? Yeshua says, what's in the heart is going to come out sooner or later. And if there's this and this and this in the heart, it's going to be seen. For people to say, don't judge my outside, I can do whatever I want, but my heart is okay. Hey, you're living in two worlds. You're in contradiction. It's schizophrenia. You got some kind of problem. Take a drug or get saved. I don't know. But one of those things, you got to do something here. You can't swing from that far end of the pendulum and go to this far end of the pendulum and think everything's fine. Guess what? We've gone from one of the four quadrants to the far extreme in the other four corner of the four quadrants, and we're missing the picture. See, someone who's got clean hands is not just someone who doesn't do things. We talk about, what do your hands do? Yeshua took his hands and he laid them on the lepers and he blessed them and he healed them and he took the children up in his arms and he blessed them and he touched the eyes of the blind and he healed them. And what did his hands do? His hands were tools of the blessing of God. They were clean from sin, but they did good things. If your heart is pure, then it's going to come out in your actions. If we take a look at what James says, or actually Yaakov says, the hardest thing for us to tame is the tongue. It's the last thing we do. That's why the text picks it. Who does not swear falsely can keep from telling lies. So, four quadrants. Two positive, two negative. In every way. Well, that's a sobering thought. Because none of us are perfect. Not one of us has the right to go into the presence of God on our own. But the text doesn't leave us on our own, because it talks about the generation of those who seek the God of Jacob, that they will receive blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. We receive grace and salvation and righteousness, which allow us to come into the presence of God, not based on our human efforts, not based on how we're dressed, not based on how we keep the rules, but based on the grace of God poured out in each of our lives, we can then go into His presence. What a wonderful thing. Because now it's not about making the grade. It's about receiving forgiveness. The text goes on, and it's, of course, part of the amazing Handel's Messiah, and the Hallelujah chorus is part of that, and you would be amazed, but Jews in Israel love Handel's Messiah. I went last Christmas to a production of Handel's Messiah sung by a German choir from Stuttgart who came to Israel, who actually, as part of their performance, sang Hatikvah. People wept as Germans singing Hatikvah in Hebrew. And they sang the Handel's Messiah the whole thing through, and the building was full of Jews. What an amazing experience that was. And this text is part of that. And it talks about that in the end, lift up your gates, your heads, O ye gates, and everlasting doors that the King of Glory may come in. Who is the King of Glory? The Lord of hosts, the Lord glorious in battle, the Lord strong and mighty. He is the King of hosts. And the doors open for Him by themselves. We, on our own strength, have no right to stand in the presence of God on our own grounds, our own merits. But as we receive His grace and His salvation and His blessing and His righteousness, as we look at our lives and understand what holiness is, and we get it in balance and we get the picture, we're not perfect, but He is with us. We can come into His presence, but there is one. When He comes to the doors open on their own, and He comes into the very presence of His Father on His own merits, and that is the King of Glory, and He is our Lord and our Messiah. And I give thanks to God for Him because of His sacrifice, His, the righteous for the unrighteous, we can all come into God's presence. And that is His gift to us. Amen.